This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. Today's guest is Martin Hockham, who has been at the sharp end of some significant global events in a distinguished and varied career.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the next edition of Treasury Matters from Alma. I'm Justin Fox. Chris Blake is taking a well-earned break this week, so I'm the chair of Alma. I'm also the group treasurer for Virgin Money, if you don't know me. And I'm really pleased to introduce Martin Hockham. Martin is our guest this week. Martin, do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself before we get into our topic today?
Sure. Hi, Justin. Great to see you again. Yeah, so my background really has been in treasury management and ALM management, mostly around the large UK banks. You know, so my career kind of spanned through banks such as Lloyds, HBOS and RBS. And in the last few years, I've been working in the Middle East for the First Bank of Abu Dhabi. And I've now just moved on from that, and I'm a NED at the Hanley Building Society. So quite a portfolio of different institutions and experiences.
And clearly that's sort of over some time. I mean, one of the things that we wanted to cover off today is crisis management and how Treasury functions respond to those circumstances. And I think what you wanted to sort of talk about today were the experiences you clearly went through at RBS, but also the experiences more recently from COVID when you were at First Abu Dhabi Bank. We're all familiar with the three lines of defense model. I always take the view that whilst Treasury is the first line of defense, in banking, it's also the last line of defense when things go wrong. I think is that something you'd agree with, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was just like reflecting, Justin, that, you know, throughout my career, which is about 40 years, I think I've been in about three or four crises that, according to all the models, are supposed to occur once every 1,000 years or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, we're in a world where every 10 years you'd expect something to happen that's quite dramatic. So I think that for everyone on the call, these are things to prepare for. And I think the crises are the most interesting learning points. You know, you learn more when things are going wrong than when things are going right. So, yeah, so of those crises, the ones that really stand out for me were the global financial crash in 2008 and, as you were saying, COVID in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the crisis kicking off back in, it was August 2007. I was nationwide at the time and I was in my car heading to the head office at Swindon and I got a phone call from the dealing desk saying, we can't fund. And I remember going, what do you mean you can't fund, right? This is markets, they're always available. I know there's a bit of noise coming out of the States. What do you mean you can't fund it? And the guy said to me, we can't fund. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to Swindon. I'm coming back to Northampton and have a chat. Now, clearly things moved quite quickly through 2007. The story around what happened at RBS is well known. Yeah. But you were in the room when these discussions were happening at the very epicenter of financial crisis. What was it like?
Incredibly stressful. And it didn't run all according to the books. And I guess like most organizations, you know, we had our playbook and so on. And I just thought it'd be interesting just to kind of compare and contrast, you know, reality with, you know, yeah, how you prepare for these things. And
so there was an actual playbook at RBS, because I know at Nationwide, we didn't have a playbook around that. We'd sort of drilled crises, but a lot of it was figuring things out as you went along. So you had a playbook at RBS.
Yeah, exactly. And step back and just think, well, yeah, part of our playbook and, you know, our governance process was scanning the market, market intelligence, you know, looking at the horizon, early warning indicators and all the other things that I expect the Treasury to have. And then, of course, I just can say, well, were there things out there that we should have been more alert to? And the big thing that happened, going back to your thing, was in 2007, the Northern Rock. And at that time, I was actually working at Lloyds Bank. I don't think I've mentioned this to you before, Justin, but yeah, in 2000 and 2007, I think it was about September, October 2007, when the Northern Rock thing kind of really became prominent. We were invited at Lloyds Bank to take a look at Northern Rock to see if, I suppose in today's terminology, there was a recovery and resolution that needed, and was a private sector solution available. So it was really quite interesting because I went with the treasurer of Lloyds Bank to Newcastle, and we looked through the, you know, the financial position, the treasury positions, and the funding situation for Northern Rock. And actually other colleagues in the bank, in the retail bank and operations, were doing their kind of due diligence, if I can put it in those terms. And when we came back, it was quite interesting because the retail and the operations guys were full of enthusiasm for Northern Rock because they were saying, you know, their systems are really up to date. We could leverage those. It'd be great for in Lloyds. And the view that we, on the funding side, which is of course the thing that it created, you know, so much disruption for them, was that we thought, well, given the amount of funding that needed to be rolled, it was in the context of Lloyds, you know, maybe about a third of the amount. And we thought that given our market capacity and standing, we could do all that. But the interesting thing was that we also took a view that if this has happened to Northern Rock, what if markets get volatile in the future? And then, you know, we're not in the normal market we're in now, which we're confident of navigating. So when we went back, we made a suggestion, which is to say to the Bank of England, that the board and the people we're in contact with, that we can do the transaction, but we just might want a backup line for the funding that we were taking from Northern Rock if it happened, to be backed up for the next 12 months so that if there were some market disruption, the Bank of England would give support on that funding. And at the time, the Bank of England responded and said, no, we can't do that. That's moral hazard. If you want to do it, you do it as a pure free market private solution. And that was the thing that, from what I heard from the board, was the thing that when the board came to consider this, that they said, well, without that, we're not confident to progress. So that was then quite an interesting point for us. And again, it's one of those what-ifs of history, because what then subsequently happened, it's all happening in real time. So we'd finished this process, I think, on the Thursday or the Friday. On Sunday evening, BBC, because I remember watching it on the TV, the news came on that Northern Rock had got into troubles and it was being taken over by the Bank of England. Nothing to worry about. Carry on. And of course, on the Monday, we saw all in the history books now, but the queues outside Northern Rock and the whole thing unfolded that way. And to me, it would always be one of those unknown questions about, had the Bank of England agreed to giving this backup line, whether or not then the headline would have been Lloyds Bank are taking it over. We'd had a plan to put the chief executive on saying that any customer of Northern Rock can come into the branch, Lloyds will be supplying the cash that can come to Lloyds Bank and so on. Whether or not that would have changed that particular direction, whether or not the crisis would have come out that way. So
it's kind of fascinating because I remember distinctly at the time there was endless conversations with the bank around providing effectively facilities, right, on a secure basis to support funding access. And eventually the bank did end up agreeing to put facilities in place. I think it was sort of mid-December.
Yeah.
In 2007, but equally they then set up the special liquidity scheme, right? And that became the FLS, FLS became TFS, TFS became TFSME. I mean, you know, there's always been an uninterrupted period whereby there's been amazing central bank support for the banking sector. That's now changing now as we sort of see the end of TFSME. So that's an amazing observation. But the second thing I would say is, if you guys were concerned, Lloyds, at the time about, you know, funding access and considering purchasing Northern Rock, you then went on to buy HBOS, which was an even bigger fish to swallow.
Well,
but that's probably a slightly different conversation, right? You probably moved on by then.
Yeah, I had moved on. And I think, you know, as you say, the circumstances had changed. And I don't think that Lloyds had the right. I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't. But I think that, as you say, there was a kind of a force majeure from the bank and the institution to to do that, whereas the Northern Rock thing was something it was felt you could choose whether or not to do it. So, but interesting kind of thing. And then
if we can sort of then sort of propel a little bit forward, because that's a very interesting anecdote around Northern Rock and that concern around funding access.
Yeah.
You then join RBS, right? And you're head of, I guess you were head of ALM and liquidity and funding, right? Yeah. So you're in the hot seat in autumn 2008. We've seen the collapse, I guess, of Lehman's. We've seen the collapse of AIG. Yeah. I mean, I remember those 3 months, that period, that autumn turning into winter, as being very stressful. What was it like? What was the atmosphere like in the treasury function at RBS at that time? And I suppose if we think about crisis management, what were the key things that you learned during that very intense period? So what are your observations from that time?
Yeah, well, as you say, after Northern Rock, as we got into 2008, I joined RBS in September 2008. Perfect timing for when,
oh, my word.
My colleague at Lloyd's at the time sent me an email, Martin, from the frying pan into the fire.
And, that's exactly what was going through my head. Frying pan.
Certainly the emotion around it. But no, RBS had recognised that this was coming. RBS, just for everyone's benefit, you know, had gone through an amazing period of growth, because 7 or 8 years previously, RBS had taken over NatWest, which was about 3 or 4 times RBS in balance sheet terms. It was already a very large bank. And in 2008, they'd taken over AB and AMRO. So by the time I joined, the RBS balance sheet was somewhere up there at $2 trillion. It was phenomenal. It was like more or less on the same size as HSBC.
Unbelievable. It was the largest bank in the world at the time. I remember you and I used to do presentations on this when we were at RBS around the sort of lessons learned. I mean, it's kind of incredible. And a lot of that was probably being funded at the short end, right, through the sort of markets business.
Yeah, and these, you see, were the observations. You looked at the report and accounts for wholesale funding for RBS. You could see there was $300 billion under 3 months. And Lloyd's Bank, when I'd been there, you know, just, you know, the month before, was only a $600 billion kind of balance sheet in total. It was maybe $100 billion of funding in total across all maturities, and maybe, you know, $20 billion under 3 months. So the contrast was staggering. And I think it's another thing that I've picked up about how institutions manage things, because if you wanted to understand about, you know, that Bob Diamond thing, Justin, about he made that statement that culture is what happens when people aren't looking.
Yeah.
Culture that is around there. And I think that going back to the Lloyd's Bank, I think the reason we were quite conservative is because Lloyd's Bank itself was quite a conservative culture. When I walked into RBS, they had a slogan on the wall of every wall. You know, so as you got out the lift, you'd see this slogan, and the slogan was "Make it happen." You know, Lloyd's didn't have a slogan like that, but I think if I could have backdated it, it would have said at Lloyd's something like "Stay safe." And I think, you know, the deals, the AB and AMRO deal, and so on, that culture had affected the whole bank. So people weren't looking so much at the risks on the balance sheet, but as what the rewards would be.
And presumably, because we always took the argument within RBS Treasury, right? We were guardians of the balance sheet. If you're coming in and effectively challenging some of the soundness of the decision-making, given that mentality, that must have been really tough.
Yeah, it was very tough. And, you know, you had to have some really uncomfortable conversations. Even after, and if I just go through about what it was like being there and the kind of communications, because what happened, and it's very similar to the, you know, what you were saying earlier about the call you got from the guys when they couldn't get any funding. In my case, it was just like 10 o'clock in the morning. I got a call from our head of money market saying they had a rolling facility with the US banks of about $15, $20 billion. We can't roll this funding. Okay, so we had a playlist. And so I kind of, I knew this playlist. I said, okay, well, then what about the other markets that you can fund in? Because we'd have conversations at ALCOs and, you know, other things beforehand in the previous months about what we'd do if the market's tight.
Your shopping list of things that you basically, you run book.
Yeah.
Presumably that list was getting quite short by that point.
Yeah. And one of the lessons learned is, you know, be skeptical about what people are claiming is possible and viable. So in the playbook, it said, well, you know, we've got, yeah, but we've also got access to all the UK markets. So I said, what about, you know, we're one of the big four clearers. Surely we can arrange something with HSBC and other banks, you know, Barclays, whatever. Well, no, because, you know, because the US has got this disruption, it's kind of spilling over and there isn't the depth and capacity. Okay, well, the other thing that you guys told me is that RBS had a big CD issuance program, but it was only 1% of all the outstanding CD issuance or CP issuance and so on of the total market capacity. And they always used to say, we're a drop in the ocean. We'll never have problems rolling that because the market is just so large compared to our tiny 0.5%, you know, kind of footprint in it. That didn't work either. So we went through the list and every market was... So then I went to the other side of the balance sheet. And again, during our conversations, had been assured that, yes, you know, the markets area has got a big balance sheet, 300 or 400 billion out of that 2 trillion. But this is marketable assets. This is stuff that can be sold. I said, well, start selling some of that stuff. Well, we can only do that if we take massive haircuts and it will destroy the capital base of the bank. So,
and the capital base at the bank notoriously at that point was sort of sub 4% of CET1. So you were very thinly capitalized. You'd done the rights issue. Yeah. So it's sort of a perfect storm.
It's the perfect storm. So what happened after that was that I emailed and then called the person at the Bank of England that dealt with RBS and said, Houston, we've got a problem type of message. And subsequently, we went to the Bank of England with the global head of our markets, the head of money markets and myself, explained the situation. And then we had a moment, and because the deputy governor at the Bank of England kind of asked this question, he said, well, what will happen if you don't get this money? Now, I'm going to do a little detour here, Justin.
Okay.
Part of this call is also about building your career and so on. But I recall about 2 or 3 years earlier, the risk director had his ear bent by some consultant or another saying, you know what, forget credit risk. Forget market risk, forget operational risk. Biggest risk your bank is running and every bank is running in the UK is settlement risk. You go out and find out how big every day your FX and BACs and RTA. So this kind of panic went up at the time. You know, they've identified a new risk and it's not on our radar. So basically, I was given the job of going around and working with all the operations guys and figuring how all these systems works and what the risk mitigation was. And it was really fascinating to find out. And at the time, though, however, I wanted to do some like really sexy stuff, doing market risk on the with the traders and learning about the gilt markets and mortgage-backed securities. And here I am figuring out how the payment plumbing works. But the lessons I learned from that were tremendous, actually. And it's a very, very kind of interrelated, complex ecosystem.
We now all worry about these things, intraday settlement, clearing, because there were some institutions during this crisis that their settlement banks, right, refused to settle unless they had cleared funds. That intricate part of the whole system became unstuck. So that must have been incredibly valuable for you to spend time doing that.
Exactly. And the learning point from that, if you like, for everyone on you know, listens to the podcast, that you know, may get asked to do things that you don't immediately see the value of. Always do it, enthusiasm, because sometimes you go into these things. And I've known other people that have got deeply into FX payment systems and settlement risks and so on and learned an awful lot from it. That when you come back to, you know, real life treasury market experience, it's absolutely invaluable. So that was like a slight lemma, but coming back now to the conversation. So the question was, well, what will happen? And I said, well, what will happen is that RBS customers will go with their cards tomorrow and the cards won't work in the ATMs and the point of sale points, you know, in the supermarkets and whatever. And that really crystallized the thing, because one could have said, well, we'll have to cut back on lending. We'll have to reprice our deposits. And all of that was absolutely true. But in order to get the engagement that we needed and to stick the of urgency. So in a sense, after that, the conversation kind of then, if I can use the expression that our former boss used to say, just, you know, it went up to the adults. So we left and we were told by the bank to get hold of the CEO and the chairman and to, for them to call. And they in turn went to see the governor and, you know, there was a meeting of the court of the Bank of England. And after that, the conversations kind of were held at that level and the steps that were taken were done. And just in terms of that, one of the other things about personal relationships that the governor of the bank had very, very good relationships with Ben Bernanke, who was at the Fed at the time. And he unlocked the dollar funding and so on with a whole series of agreements. But again, so I think about that, about, you know, we don't kind of get to meet each other as much now with teams and work from home and so on. But building good, strong relationships with people, I know that's really at the top of the house, but we all do it in our careers with people around us. So again, you know, good learning points about.
And I think since that time, I would certainly say the Bank of England's been more on the front foot of engaging with market participants. They see that as a vital part to get that sort of market intelligence and that flow of information. But I couldn't agree with you more on the need to build those deep and broad relationships, particularly because sometimes firms can be very inward looking. Do you know what I mean? And looking at their issues. So building that sort of external set of contacts across a diverse range of firms and actors is really important.
Yeah, exactly. And I think an interesting question that then comes from it, Justin, is, you know, what we saw then in the subsequent years was the massive effort on behalf of Basel and the regulators to reconstitute the way they regulated quantitative metrics, LCR, NSFR, more narrative approaches, ILAs and ICAPs and everything like that. Then following that, recovery and resolution plans. So I suppose the question that I always remember, Paul Tucker, who was one of the deputy governors at the Bank of England, he wrote about this and he was kind of asked, how long before all of these measures will you say that the system would be able to sustain a crisis like 2008 and come out the other side of it without needing central bank support and government support and so on and so on? You've been at Virgin Money as the treasury now. From our conversations, you've had lots of building up your MREL and all of the tools and all of the measurements that you need to have. So how much safer do you think the system is now, Justin?
Relative to 2007, it's night and day.
Yeah.
But equally, I think the attitude of governments and regulators and participants has changed. I mean, let's just look through the last few years, right? We had the COVID crisis, which I know you want to talk about in terms of how to manage that type of crisis. But effectively, if you look at the volatility of the markets in March 2020, it was incredible. But central banks and organizations came together. Here in the UK, we had TFS became TFSME, and there was a huge injection of liquidity into the market. But at the same time, Bank of England, the PRA, were saying, well, look, let's preserve capital ratios because we really don't know how this is going to play out. So stop paying dividends, stop distributing capital back.
Yeah.
Then I think more recently, right, if I think back to last spring, we had the collapse of Credit Suisse. We had the very sudden collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. Again, and a lot of market volatility over that spring period. Now, whilst central banks, at least outside of the US, didn't do any extraordinary intervention, they were clearly keeping a close eye on things, and banks managed to navigate those scenarios very, very well. I think for me, when we look at this internally, we do try and learn from the lessons of 07 and 08. But equally, when we're thinking about how we should consider, let's say, liquidity and liquidity resources, we're saying, well, 07, 08 is quite distant. The issues then aren't the same now. They're different issues. So we worry about velocity, you know, the digitization of banking. We worry about the velocity at which funds can flow out, but also the quantum of resources. And again, so I think about primary liquidity and secondary liquidity, i.e. that stock of collateral that you have accessible at the central bank. But equally, we're more attuned to things like social media, right?
Yeah.
As an impact that can influence. And so we've got early warning indicators around that. So the system is far more resilient. We have the stress testing process to prove that. But equally, there's this constant need to test yourself, I think, within Treasury to say, if something went wrong, could we act fast enough and take the necessary steps to prevent a problem becoming a crisis? We certainly saw that in 2023, that sort of knock-on effect for the other US regional banks as a result, and sort of extraordinary intervention by the US government at that particular point in time. So it's always a learning process.
I mean, like the Silicon Valley thing, I know that their subsidiary in the UK was relatively small, but over a weekend, an HSBC, and I think both sides, the central banks and the commercial banks, realised that keeping financial stability is so important that doing deals quickly, and they've got the tools to be very agile. So the system's far better positioned and the central banks are far more on the front foot than 2008. The big question is if it was a really kind of a tidal wave like that 2008, again, it was like really, really super big banks like Lehman's and RBS and so on, how it would play out. I think it'd be a lot better than it was. But as you say, you just have to keep on improving with time. And the other interesting thing that, you know, some of the papers that were written at the time, and again, this thing, just good, poor perspective for people on the call, that David Miles, who was at the Bank of England, really great papers. So if you looked at a time study from 1950 to 2010, 1950, 1960, a typical bank would have 25% capital. That's not risk-weighted capital. That is 25% of the balance sheet was pure capital. So we're still quite a long way from there, even with all the improvements that have come along. So interesting to see where that goes. Yeah.
Can I take a slightly different juncture this time, right? So clearly you had a very stressful but amazing experience at RBS in 2008 and onwards, and particularly that whole restructuring journey. You get to 2020, you're now group treasurer of a large Middle Eastern bank, and a pandemic arrives, which no one had sort of foretold. How did you use that experience from RBS days to sort of help you in your response to dealing with COVID, both, I guess, because it was a combination of, yes, you've got to protect the balance sheet, but also we now need to work from home.
Yeah.
And how do you keep your team together, but also exercise the right amount of controls that a treasury function needs to do over a balance sheet?
Yeah, it was. I mean, for the Middle East and for the United Arab Emirates and the bank I was in, this was a real existential crisis, wasn't it, for all of us? And of course, it was a lot more wider than the 2008 thing. This was the entire economy shutting down, hospitals under stress, and all sorts of other things happening. The first thing that hit me, Justin, was I just thought, how on earth are we going to be able to manage going out of the offices into our home workplaces? We have not at all rehearsed the IT.
Yeah.
We've done lots of contingency planning about head office gets closed down because of a fire or whatever it might be.
Exactly. Remember that? We'd always have a secondary site that we thought we'd rock up to, and there was always a complaint, there are never enough desks or something that. And it's like, no, you can't go there now, right? Because it's, you know, everything's shut.
Yeah, so the good thing that amazed me about 2020 was actually that the IT within a month was actually, it was pretty good across the whole banking industry from what I could see, certainly across all the banks in the Middle East that we were working with. So that was the one area where I was really, really concerned, and actually came out better than I thought. So I just kind of thought that was quite, you know, I was just thinking about it earlier today before the conversation. But in terms of the pressure on the banks, this was tremendous, because the closing down of the world economy, if you're in a country where half of its exports are energy related, and in our case in the bank that half of our balance sheet was kind of energy related, seeing the price of oil collapse from $70 down to $10, in fact, at one point. It was only a day, but it was a technicality where oil actually went negative in price.
Yes, I remember that.
Because the ships couldn't actually unload the oil because the refineries didn't need it, and it was a burden to them. But the wider picture was that the UAE as a country was trying to do several things through this period leading up to COVID. One was to make the UAE, if you like, the Singapore or the London or the New York of the Middle East, so that Abu Dhabi would be the financial heart and centre. So it was investing a lot in banking and in financial services and in creating exchanges and all that kind of thing for financial services. And the other thing it was doing on a big scale was diversifying its economy away from the energy sector. They recognised that they wanted that to shrink as a proportion of the economy and to develop areas like tourism, which they were doing very, very, very successfully. Then suddenly, bang, 2020 comes and it impacts that energy sector hugely and it impacts the tourism industry. And so I think that one of the big changes on this one, and I was kind of sitting there at the is that I thought the thing we've got to do first and foremost is protect our customers, almost like over ahead of the bank, because it was going to be obvious that the hotels and the airlines and so on, their revenues would just like fall overnight, basically. They still have lots of costs that they needed to manage. And to do that, we needed to have a big program around forbearance and big outreach into the central bank. Now, as all this was happening, the Western financial system, the US and Europe and the UK, were kind of already doing the kind of things you mentioned earlier about putting in funding schemes, forbearance schemes, and so on. So it was kind of good because we were the kind of lead bank with the central bank. So the key things that enabled us to get through it were, one, we had very, very strong relationships with the central bank. So I reached out to immediately and with our executive. And so we had very strong engagement from day one about we need to work on this together. And you can see what they're doing it in America and Europe. So they were kind of very much willing to do that with us. And then secondly, if I could say three words that were over and above everything, it was communication, communication, communication.
Do you know, I was just about to say that, because just reflecting on my time, because I was at Oxfam right when the crisis kicked off, right? So you're literally worrying about how you fund countries. But then I took on the VM role, and communication has become so important in managing a crisis, particularly when everybody's working remotely. Because one, you want to check in on people, make sure that they're okay. But working together on a remote basis, because we were all used to being in an office and you'd lean over a computer monitor and you'd have a chat with somebody. But do you know what I mean? Communication is so vital.
Yeah, exactly. And we'd kind of gotten to a situation where we saw what the impacts were being on the balance sheet. I mean, we had to basically make some big decisions about what sectors we could support, which sectors, which geographies we could do with, where we couldn't extend future credit and so on and so on. And there was almost like a moment in this that kind of was a turning point for me, because I was talking with the chief executive about this constantly, trying to get the message through to the business. But the businesses and the business heads were still in the thing that we've got our profit targets to hit because they've just hiked up the FTP rate. So he'd get lots of, you know, so there's all this conversation going around and Treasury's not making all the funding available that we need. So we kind of got to a point where I sat down with the chief and I said, look, you know, we need to pull this together, but we need to communicate to the business that in the parlance we've got now, this is safety and soundness, not returns, that has to be the priority. So he then did an email which was headed liquidity, liquidity, and kind of said, everyone, your P&L targets, don't worry about it. We'll get finance to recalculate them. What we need to do in the next month is just make sure that we're able to support our key clients and that they've got the funds to keep their businesses moving over and so on, and to ensure that the bank itself has got the funding it needs to fund rollovers on the balance sheets and all that kind of stuff that, you know, anyone in Treasury would be very familiar with. As soon as you wrote that, that then changed the atmosphere, because then people, you know, they needed the reassurance that they were not going to be held to account for these P&L targets that had been set, you know, 6 months prior to COVID ever hitting. That communication and then the buy-in and so on, those were the vital things that enabled us to get through. And then, as you say, communication was worse. I was just kind of on calls 8 hours a day. I'd have team meetings once a week with all my team, back to your point about keeping things together. And then we'd have special topics coming up that we need to do as well. So once that kind of came through, and then the system kind of settled down, again, the communication with customers was key, with our key depositors and so on and so on.
Yeah.
So it felt very different from the 2008 for a number of reasons. One, I think that because the management themselves were much more aware of all the risks, and the last few years they'd been constantly told, you know, through ICAPS and other stuff can go wrong. And so that was a good positive thing that came from the 2008 experience. And I think just also that they then got a clear sense of direction, and once things had settled down, then we're on back on the road to recovery.
Let me come in there, because I've just been sort of reflecting on what you've been saying, and this will lead to my next question, right? So you probably want to drink a water, Martin. There are three things I take away from the last few years, right? Three things I take away. One of the things that we've put in place at VM is, yes, early warning indicators are useful, but some of them are a bit lagged, right? And so we've got something that we call heightened monitoring, and it's very markets driven. Ultimately, it's my judgment call as treasurer. But if I see something in the market that basically makes me feel nervous, then I can basically flip on what I call heightened monitoring. And it just means that for my front office guys, for my teams, we're on alert that something could go wrong. But I also flag it up with the CFO and with the CEO, saying, look, we're nervous. And we've done that a few times over the last few years, most notably when we had the Truss mini budget. And that leads me on to the second point. The second point I want to, what we've put in place is, we're not a big bank, right? We're reasonably small. It comes back to your point about communication, is how do you talk to the business side of the folks? We put in, you know, using Teams, we put in something we call a treasury briefing. And it's where my markets guys do a 3 times a day update to all the product guys in the bank, to say, well, look, this is what's going on in the market. This is where rates are moving, because clearly we've been in a much more volatile environment, or there's something interesting out there. And what we're trying to connect is treasury with the business. And that proved really useful during the Truss episode, because we could say, well, look, we want to bring in savings because markets aren't functioning properly. Do we need to reprice? That communication tool, particularly if you don't run a markets business, is really important. And the third point, and this will lead on to my next question, is, you know, it's that role play aspect that you do with the leadership team and with the board. So post SVB, you know, our CEO said, right, I want to do a fire drill now around, if we had a crisis situation, we had, you know, a run scenario for the bank over a weekend, have we got all the right information to hand? And to your point earlier about settlements and payments, what's the connectivity between what we're seeing in the payment side of things through to the resources that Treasury are happening? We did that with the bank's leadership team, but we also did it with the board. Now, you've transitioned from an exec career into a NED career. And how does that feel now that you're overseeing and you're the one sort of keeping an eye on management? How have your experiences influenced your approach as a NED?
Yeah, it's kind of doing the NED role. It really does make you kind of have to stand back and just take a much wider horizon about what those event risks are really. Like your treasury craft, we've been focused all on these things, on markets. And I think what you're doing, and hopefully other family, you know, is excellent. And I think that scanning the horizon and having that thing is good. And then you up the monitoring. Going into this NED role, however, has kind of made me kind of step back and think, well, actually, things can happen over quite a wide range of events. And the one I'd say that has really hit me going in there is the risk about a cyber attack.
Yeah.
because it's not theoretical. I mean, we see cyber attacks all the time on major institutions in the country, and we know there are people out there actively trying to break down systems and so on. And it's the one where if it does occur, and you just kind of walk in and on your screen is, you know, one of those pirate things and, you know, pay us £5 million or else kind of thing. For almost all the other things, there are levers we can pull. There's a problem with the branches or the operational settlements go down or the intranet or whatever it might be. We can't fund on a particular day. There's something we can do about all of that. But that IT one, so it's kind of heightened the alertness around that kind of level of risk. And consequently, and this is the doing of the organization, but the protocols around training and education on IT, cyber, anti-phishing and so on, password controls, the strength of passwords. It's really deeply inside the culture because that, you know, that's being recognized. And
I guess the thing is then, Martin, if you reflect back on your career, because as you said to begin with, you've gone through several one in 1,000 year type events in a 40-year career. Maybe you're just unlucky about the sort of timing of your career. But I guess the point is, each of those stress scenarios, the root cause has been something different. It's always something different. And I suppose that point is around that vigilance around, well, what are the risks? Because banks are critical to the functioning of an economy, but it's always different. But then I suppose the actions we take as Treasury, they are the same sort of playbooks that we would have. We refine them. And one of the things I say to my guys when we're updating our recovery and resolution guys is I want a framework. I don't want to be prescriptive because effectively you've got to figure it out. You've got to make sense of the circumstances you find yourself in. So what I want is a framework. I don't want to be prescriptive. And sometimes that can be a little challenging of sort of talking that through with the regulators because they like prescription sometimes. And it's like, no, I need flexibility because I don't know what could happen, but I want to make sure that my team are ready and prepared and definitely supported. Is that your sort of similar conclusion?
That's it. And the other kind of area you mentioned earlier, just about like digitalization and, you know, the fact that all the systems and all the stuff, you know, going on the cloud and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
I just think, what happens if something happens to the cloud?
Somebody said to me the other day, right? Somebody said to me, who knew that the cloud would run out of space? And I'm like, really? You know, but yeah. In theory, you can get space limited. Yeah. On the cloud. And I was like, wow, geez. I thought that was quite amazing.
Well, we're so dependent, you know, aren't we, on all these like GPS and iPhones and so on. And again, I don't know enough about it, but if there's a solar flare and, you know, the satellites get knocked out, how does all that then impact on all of the, you know, all of the things we're taking for granted that we're open and people then go on their phones and they can't see what their balance is. And if they walk the branch, does the branch know it, or are they dependent on similar technologies? So
like, I suppose if I go back to your risk consultant who was in RBS and saying it's settlement risk, it's not market risk, it's not credit risk. The way I think about that now is I think things like credit risk, market risk, liquidity risk are reasonably quite well understood, right? And certainly over the last 17 years since the crisis, there's been a lot of good work done.
Yeah.
But increasingly, regulators, and I think this is absolutely right, regulators are focusing on things like operational risk or operational resilience. Some people might see it as a bit of a catch-all for everything, but ultimately, that's what we're all running. It's just a huge degree of operational risk, be it cyber, be it fraud, be it systems failure. I think that's the key thing.
Yeah, as you said, right at the front of the conversation about just being aware that the nature of the risks keeps on moving and changing. So the risks back in 2008 were much more around balance sheet and that kind of thing. Things now, I mean, we know we're competing in a space where banks are becoming so digitalized that we're information exchanges. And so but far more kind of common vulnerabilities, you know, so things like Twitter and Facebook and that kind of than we ever did in the past. And so And those risks are probably less understood by bankers, to be frank. Certainly bankers like from my generation that are very, very conversant in treasury and ALM and so on. But these other risks that are really prominent, and if they hit, will then potentially have major impacts on all of the other metrics that we track. So yeah, be curious and just keep on asking questions and dig into new horizons and events.
Martin, it's been lovely talking to you. I suppose the thing that always sort of comes back to my mind is, remember we used to go into JC's office, right? John Cummins's office.
Yeah.
And he'd have that big picture above his desk. Now, it was either, you know, with trepidation or elation that you walked into John's office, right? Because it was going to be one or the other. And I remember first time I saw it, and I said, why do you have that picture? And for those who don't know, a huge picture of a queue outside a Northern Rock branch, wasn't it? And he used to say, because he said, every time somebody comes in here with an off-the-wall idea, and I look at them and, you know, taciturnly, you know, in terms of, you know, being skeptical, and they'd look at me and go, well, what's your problem with this? You know, why aren't you supportive? And John would turn around and said, my job is to prevent that. And he would point up at that picture, because that's my job as treasurer. It's been fantastic talking to you, Martin, this afternoon. You've been a huge supporter of ALMA over the years. Do you think we're doing the right things in terms of ALMA? I mean, you were a big part of the educational setup. Are we on the right track? Are we focusing on the right things?
Yeah, you know, I think it's come on a long way, actually. I mean, I suppose I was really active in ALMA 7 or 8 years back, and I look now at the programs, the professionalism, and the fact that ALMA's kind of got like full-time people dedicated in, very good support, so it's continuous. I look at the agenda of the evenings you have. I saw, you know, you had one in Leeds recently. And I just think the emphasis is on knowledge sharing. And that's where ALMA's always got to be. It's got a good qualification, which again is really well settled down and well grounded. So to me, if you're in the ALM world, you know, the ALMA qualification is the best qualification because it's so practical and it's so real, written by practitioners and delivered by practitioners. And the education sessions and the conferences. Yeah, I'm really pleased that ALMA's on such a strong footing.
Any final thoughts, Martin?
No, just to keep going, really, Justin, and I'll try and get to ALMA events. I'm always invited, and I'll try to get to as many of them as I can, you know, both ones after work and the regional conferences and so on. Really enjoy being involved with ALMA. I learn a lot from speaking with people in ALMA at the conferences. I just hope that, you know, we continue to prayer. And you know, I just thank you, Justin. I know, having been chairman myself some years back, I think the probably grown since then. So thanks for all the work and effort you've put into that for the last 4 or 5 years.
Perfect. Martin, thank you very much for taking the time this afternoon. I look forward to maybe hosting some more podcasts in the future, but have a good afternoon, everybody, and we'll see you all soon.
Cheers, Justin.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon, and in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?